Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with Glenn David Gold, and we will talk about his new novel, his second, that's just recently out. The title of the book is Sunnyside, and it's a big story with a very big cast. One of the characters is Charlie Chaplin. It's a book that deals with many different themes. It looks at the nature of fame, looks at the importance of movies in our lives, a lot of other things besides. It's a great book, and I would encourage people to go out and take a look at it. Knopf is the publisher. His first novel, Carter Beats the Devil, also was very well read, enjoyed, reviewed. It's been translated into 14 languages. His short stories and essays have appeared in McSweeney's, Playboy, the New York Times Magazine. He makes his home in San Francisco. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. So as questions occurred to you, if you want to join the conversation, that's great. You can call us at 333-9455. That's if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. The toll-free line, if it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. So whichever of those numbers works for you, you can give us a call. Please, though, we ask people to be brief so we can keep moving and hope people try and keep their comments relevant to the topic. But other than that, you're certainly welcome to call. Again, here, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Gold, hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing extremely well.
Good. Very good. I thank you very much for talking with us. I enjoyed this book very much. And also, I read a number of years ago, I read Carter Beats the Devil, which I enjoyed too. So both of them I enjoyed very much. The story here, Sunnyside, begins, the story that you used to open the book, is a strange story. On one day, people all over the country believe that they have seen Charlie Chaplin in the guise of the tramp that they would have known from the movies.
Right.
What about that story grabbed you so much that you thought, this is great to open this book?
Well, I was reading David Robinson's biography of Chaplin, and he mentions it almost in a footnote in passing. From 1916 to 1918, Charlie Chaplin basically went from being a funny guy with baggy trousers and a mustache to being the world's most famous person. And he sort of just gives off this list of, you know, there were toys, you know, there were candies, there were comic books, and, oh, by the way, one day there was a mass hysteria in 800 people or 800 places in the United States. People thought they saw Charlie Chaplin. He just sort of tosses it off, and then he gives a little bit of an analysis of it. But I thought it was so weird, I had to double-check it, so I looked it up in the archives, and sure enough, there was a report in the newspapers about it, and I'd never heard anything. And it just struck me as being, you know, tailor-made for a novel.
In reading it, I thought, well, this is a great story. This is a great literary device. And I refrained from looking at anything about the book, any reviews, any interviews with you, anything, until after I had read the book.
Well, and, God bless you. Thank you.
So I was sort of surprised and delighted when I read at one point, yes, in fact, you didn't invent this. This actually happened.
Yes. Yeah. And it just seems like a little bit of magical realism happening in the center of America at a time when you wouldn't really think of such things happening. Sort of like, you know, Elvis sightings, except for it was, you know, 70 years earlier.
And I suppose part of what that says is that he was someone who had become so recognizable, so well known, that you can imagine such a thing happening. And I suppose that some people would argue that he was, there are various figures, I suppose, where we argue this was the first mass media celebrity. People have said that, for example, of Mark Twain, you know, that he was somebody that people all around the world, if you showed him a picture, they knew who it was. Well, that was before there were movies. And so at this point, maybe Chaplin would have been a quantum leap over Twain or over maybe anybody else at the time.
Yeah, that's true. Part of the book for me started because I saw, when I was researching Carter Beats the Devil, which is about a magician in San Francisco in the 1920s, there's a biography of Houdini where there was a photograph in it of Houdini and Chaplin hugging. And I thought, my own yardstick was that Houdini was the first most famous man in the world. Although I like your argument for Mark Twain, too, but Houdini knew how to manipulate the media in a great way without participating in it. You know, he wasn't a journalist like Twain. He didn't have some of the resources Twain did. All Houdini did was stand up on stage and declare himself to be Houdini. And, you know, he wasn't a king. He wasn't a pope. He didn't have a particular reason for being the most famous man in the world. He just was because of his shtick, and it was a lovely shtick. And then it struck me that Chaplin was his successor in some kind of way. But I knew that there was a difference in the quality of the fame. I knew that when you think of Houdini, you kind of think of old-time, you know, this tinny piano standing up in the corners, kind of vaudeville. And when you think of Chaplin, you think of somebody who's a little more sophisticated, who, you know, hobnobbed with Gandhi and Einstein and had a different kind of following to him. And I didn't really understand what the difference was. And I think part of the difference was the change in media, the film coming up.
At the time that you set the story in his life, he was very successful, was very famous. He was very wealthy. He was at the top of the world, at least in terms of cinema, among the top people. And yet it was a time when apparently he was feeling so dissatisfied and creatively blocked that he actually was thinking about killing off this character that had made him world famous.
Right. Well, if you watch, by the way, did you get a chance? There's no reason you should have, but did you get a chance to check out Sunnyside?
One of the things that I was really pleased to discover was that in noodling around to prepare for the interview, that you can actually watch it on YouTube.
Yeah.
I did watch a little. I didn't have the time to watch all of it. I did watch a little bit because I particularly wanted to see him dancing with the nymphs.
Yeah.
Which you describe the making of that scene in the book. So I watched a little bit of it, and when I have the opportunity, I want to go back and actually watch the whole thing.
Sure, yeah. No, I don't mean to get things out of order here, but yes, you're right. Well, it's Sunnyside. Chaplin made one terrific movie after another, basically from sort of if you almost did a graph of how good his films are. You know, they start in 1914, and they get better and better and better. And the more creative control he had, generally speaking, the better the movies were. And they start being the movies, you know, that people have heard of, like Shoulder Arms and A Dog's Life. And then there's this weird aberration in the catalog. Sunnyside, 1919, it's not just terrible. It's as if he forgot how to make a movie. Mm-hmm. And there's a bizarre scene, like two-thirds of the way through, where he does the kind of tramp walk off into the sunset that you think of at the end of a Charlie Chaplin movie, and then he's hit by a car, or he's just about to be hit by a car, and you see the car coming, and you see him preparing for the crash, and so it was obvious he was thinking of suicide for some reason in the middle of making the movie, and I had to kind of reverse engineer a potential reason for that.
Mm-hmm. So that was more, that is, his feelings at that point. That's what you're imagining for him, not so much that as a result of digging into his life, you knew that that really was what was going on at this time?
Yeah, no, I think that what was happening in his life at the time, and this is also one of the attractive points of writing about him there, is that he had literally almost unimaginable pressures on him. I mean, he was the first most famous person in the world. There was no template for how to survive with the amount of fame where people were stopping you on the street and everybody wanted something from you, and every relationship became transactional in a way, in the sense that, like, it was commerce. There's something I have Mary Pickford say late in the book, which is that for the first time ever, somebody's whereabouts are a commodity, you know? And that's what's happening to him, that crushing thing. The studio bosses are trying to put him out of business. Chaplin had a fondness for underage girls. He's married to a very young girl who might be 15, 16 years old at the time. She's pregnant. And he's just creatively at a loss. And to me, that all added up to that seemed like a pretty good explanation for why he would kill off his tramp on screen, even if he backpedaled by the end of the movie.
There are two other characters in the book. The book is sort of a mixture of characters like Chaplin, who were actually real people, and then characters that you create. And there are basically three stories that run through this book. So there's the story of Chaplin and what's going on in his life and his method of working. Then there are these two young men two young American men who end up being sent off to fight in World War I and end up going through very different experiences and different circumstances. And maybe I'd ask you to talk just a little bit about each of them, starting with this young man named Lee, who was the son of a lighthouse keeper and a failed Wild West show impresario, whose great dream was to be a movie star.
Right. You know, an American success story, right? To me, he typifies the idea that we always have that if we have an idea, it's good because we have it, you know. It's a really wonderful kind of way that things get done around in our country, which is that, you know, stick-to-itiveness, you have a dream, you follow it because it's your dream, and because it's your dream, it's got to be good. And he has a very practical mother and a very kind of wild father who, you know, his dream was to create a Wild West show in which there would be fights with giant rocks. And, of course, nobody really wanted to see that. Lee wants to be a movie star. He gets very close to it. Then he ends up getting drafted and set off to France, where the realities of war are all around him. And it ends up he learns how to instead be a son and, in his own way, a father and a human being instead of being a movie star. Because he finds two puppies on the battlefields of France. And kind of he in a way takes on a little bit of Chaplin's screen character, the side of Chaplin that's nurturing, that's always like taking care of somebody else. Mm-hmm. And by doing this, Lee starts to train the puppies, perhaps in hopes that they might become film stars, which is, of course, a completely insane idea.
And it's interesting in that he gets his wish in a way in a way which we will not reveal here.
That he
although I tell you I saw it coming long way away. But in a way that we will not reveal, people must read the book. So he gets his wish sort of. He ends up going into the movie business. But I mm-hmm. you know as a writer, I wonder how it is you think about a turn in a story like that. Some people, I guess, might say, "Okay, that one's over the top." how do you think about as a storyteller? Does anything ever get over the top?
Maybe this is an answer for you because I'm going to ask you a question back. What exactly does over the top mean? Where it's just like not believable.
I suppose that is what I would say. Yes, that it's not believable.
It's interesting. That's exactly how those dogs were discovered.
Really?
Yeah. So I mean, in a way, that's the worst defense in the world, right? Where it actually happened. You know, and when you're a teacher in a writing class, and a student gives you a story that's completely unbelievable, and you say, "I'm sorry, it's unbelievable," and the student says, "Well, it actually happened." You know, my response as a teacher is kind of helplessly, well, in that case, you failed twice. It's like you didn't just fail to convince me of something that wasn't real, but something that was real. No, Duncan, as his name became in World War One, yeah, he actually, that everything that happens to him in France is quite real. That's the story of the puppies that saved Hollywood.
That puts it in a whole different frame now for me.
Yeah, well, in that case, what happens is you get to that place where reality is more unbelievable than fiction sometimes. And, hey, blame reality, David.
All right. Our guest this morning is Glenn David Gold, and we are talking about his new novel. His second, Sunnyside, is the title. He's also the author of Carter Beats the Devil. That's his first. The new book is just out. It's published by Knopf. Go out and get it. It's a good story. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So we talked a little bit here about Lee Wheeler. Let's also talk about Hugo Black.
Yeah,
this is a young man. He grew up in Detroit. His father was a professor of engineering. His mother was a woman who seems like she feels like she didn't get the life she should have had, and that basically it's the fault of her husband, Hugo's dad. Hugo grows up kind of on the periphery of affluence, almost as if he's looking at it, across the lake and never quite knows how to get from here to there.
Right. Well, this is the other thing. Yeah, Hugo shows up in the beginning on that first day that the book starts when everybody thinks they're going to see Chaplin around the country. Hugo has the misfortune of being in a riot at a train station where everybody thinks that chaplain's going to be there. And he has a pretty low opinion of celebrity anyway. He ends up volunteering for the armed forces, and he is drafted and sent to, he volunteers, and ends up going on a little-known doomed expedition. America in 1918 sent 5,800 soldiers from Detroit. Actually, in your part of the country, it might be a little bit better known than in most of the country. Sent them over to Archangel Russia to overthrow the 2-million-man-strong Bolshevik army. The argument was that the mere presence of Western boots upon the ground would cause democracy to flower in their passing. And it didn't really work that well. Hugo, I knew, was not going to come to a particularly happy end. And I thought of him as the side of the tramp that was the more pathetic side. The side really was, and exactly as you say, his nose kind of pressed up against the window at all times when other people seem to be succeeding, and he's always the person who's a little bit more doomed.
Yeah. Well, this is another feature of the story, that is this story about this ill-fated multinational force sent to fight the Bolsheviks. Another one of those things that you might think was almost too incredible to be believed, but again, this was something that actually happened, and I don't know how anybody now could read that without thinking about the Iraq War.
I guess so, and it's interesting. One of the things that dooms, I think, fiction that's set in the past pretty quickly is trying to be contemporary or make a specific comment on a specific time, because, you know, that means Carter would have been, you know, a savage indictment of the second Clinton administration or something, you know. And that fades pretty quickly. But I think that what I was trying to put my finger on is a symptom of empire and a symptom of, you know, a general... if you can imagine it, sort of a general cheerful hegemony that comes with that, which is, you know, we got this great system. You guys, you should love us. And here, we're going to help you out by invading you. Apparently, you know, that's what happens in Iraq right now, but it's not the first time that's happened. And, you know, Britain fell prey to it commonly as well. And I think that it's something that's kind of inherent in the society. Iraq is right now. I hope there isn't another one, but it's entirely just part of the, it could be just part of the character.
Mm-hmm. Well, now also you've said something, I guess I didn't really think about it, whether you saw that in your two main fictional characters, Lee and Hugo, that somehow they were, in their experiences, their personalities were kind of reflections of the character that Chaplin created.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that's interesting. I mean, I have a quotation kind of deep in the book that Chaplin says, in a word, the whole of humanity seen from the angles of the cosmic imagination are Charlie Chaplin's. Chaplin seemed to think that he was the world in a way, and the world was him. And I thought I might try to give a chance to reflect on that a bit.
There is something, you know, after having read the book, I started thinking about the title, about Sunnyside, and about the ways that Sunnyside comes up in the book. As you've explained, it's a film by Chaplin. It's also a place, which has significance for a couple of the characters. But I started thinking more and more, and this is not something that I've noticed anybody seeming to pick up on who talked about the book, but it just seemed to me that more and more that one of the things maybe you were interested in was the fact that in any life, there are points when things take a decisive turn, when in a moment, people's lives change forever. And, maybe in some people's lives it happens more than once, but that there is that point where in a blink, everything changes. And it strikes me that's in part what this is about.
Yeah, nobody has... Good work. Yeah, nobody's pointed that out before, but it's exactly right. I was thinking kind of the flip side of it's Chinatown, Jake. You know.
Oh, yes.
It's that place and that moment in time where your life is changing, and you could have a moment of grace if only you're good enough. And for a lot of people, the closest they get is sitting in a movie theater and watching someone else have that moment of grace. That's the only time that people really recognize it. But for I don't think it gives too much away. This is like halfway through the book. You learn that Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford, who at the time were very famous movie stars and separately successful. Sunnyside is the place in Washington Irvington's estate where they were taking a walk, and they had a moment where they were alone, and they weren't movie stars. They were just two young people who suddenly realized they were in love, and they held hands. And that moment, then all of a sudden, the rest of the world sort of discovered them. And so, to me, it's like that. It's that one little second where you're just you're yourself, and everything is perfect. And if only you could stay there, you know, then everything might be okay for a while. And it is that moment of change.
And this the reason I suppose that's was important in their lives and becomes important in the story is that both of them were very, very famous, very successful, very well-loved movie stars who happen to be married to other people. And this, there's this question, if they publicly acknowledge their relationship, what's that going to mean for their careers, the way people feel about them? Will that ruin them, or will people be willing to accept that?
Right. It's funny. In one way, I think it's fairly easy to imagine. In another, I think it's almost impossible. But if you think about it, at that time, the only real form of mass media, the only moving image you could have was film back then. So, you know, no television, no internet, no cell phone cameras, no nothing. And your only way to really experience these people was to go into movie theaters and see them. That was the first profession ever that got its own set of media about it. So the first magazines that were just devoted to one profession were movie magazines. You know, the first gossip columns, really, I mean, there was a little bit about theater people, but not that much, was about people on motion picture screens. They were treated differently than anybody ever had been in history beforehand, and they were held up as exemplars of values. And it literally was not known if those people had human emotions that were anything remotely negative or seen as immoral, would the empire collapse? You know, would the bastions of morality come up and rally against them? Nobody knew. And so that Fairbanks and Pickford, who were the most, besides Chaplin, two of the most famous stars ever, that they fell in love and were having an adulterous affair, the reveal of that was something that was really, they really thought it could bring down the billion-dollar empire of Hollywood.
Doug Fairbanks was a good friend of Chaplin's. He, at least what it says in this story, is that Chaplin hated Mary Pickford, and I think that truly this was just professional jealousy. She was very successful and was a rival in terms of fame and success, and for that reason, he just hated Mary Pickford, apparently.
Yeah, well, that's in his biography. It's in all of it. It's his autobiography. It's in biographies of Pickford talking about their intense rivalry and dislike for each other. And, you know, the more you see it described, I mean, they really were very, very similar people with slightly, they had very similar work ethics, but they had a different expectation of what it was art was supposed to do. Mary Pickford was a machine. I mean, she was about giving the public exactly what it wanted, and Chaplin was about sort of scraping the edges of his soul to find out what made himself and the world tick. And so, it's boiling it down almost to the point of inaccuracy, but in a way, they were kind of art versus commerce. They had that terrible rivalry, and they only really spoke because they both loved Doug in their own ways. And I thought it would be fairly easy ways to dramatize that.
We are at our midpoint here. This is Focus 580. My name's David Inge, and the guest this morning is Glenn David Gold. He is the author of Carter Beats the Devil. That was his first novel. Did very well, and now he's produced a second. It's titled Sunnyside, and it's published by Knopf. It's just recently out. Both of the books, I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore and the library if you'd like to read them. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Yet another story that you tell in here has to do with these three, Pickford, Fairbanks, and Chaplin, and some other people, and how it is that they came together to form United Artists Studio.
Right. If it starts to seem like there's a lot of disparate threads in the story, there's kind of a general theme to the book, which is that as Chaplin was going from becoming the comedian to becoming the most famous man in the world, Hollywood was going from becoming kind of a farm town to being the cultural mecca of the universe. And I was kind of curious how those things happened. And, of course, the answer behind that is money. That money was flowing into Hollywood because suddenly it was the only game in town. The European film industry had been destroyed. And so if you wanted to watch a movie, you had to watch a Hollywood movie. When it came time to pay for the war, they were selling war bonds, and the guy who was running the Federal Reserve at the time, William McAdoo, he noticed that people liked the idea of patriotism, but it was really hard to get them to pull out their wallets and pay for it. And he noticed, however, that people would pay anything to go see Chaplin and Fairbanks and Pickford. So he came up with this idea of having Liberty Loan parades across the country. It was the third Liberty Loan drive. It was, by some measures, the largest event in American history up to that point, where the stars would go from town to town, speak on behalf of the war, the hat would get passed around, and people would buy war bonds and pay for the war. You know, the irony of Chaplin, who is basically a pacifist doing this, was not beyond me. But by the time the Liberty Loan drive was over, McAdoo was fascinated by nobody having harnessed star power before and realizing that it had a financial value to it. So he, at the end of the war, dropped out of the government and helped Fairbanks, Pickford, Chaplin, and D.W. Griffith form United Artists. So there was that immediate connection between the military and artistic ambition, I guess.
Yeah. And for them, what was at stake here was their creative control, perhaps also their ability to make money, because also at the time, the bosses of the other studios were conspiring to take control of the business. What they wanted to do was they wanted to control production. They wanted to control distribution. They wanted to own the theaters. They wanted to own everything so that then they could say to the performers, people like Chaplin and Pickford and Doug Fairbanks, they could say to them, we own you too, and you can't do nothing about it, and you'll take what we'll give you, and that'll be that.
Right, right. And what they didn't really count on was the idea that celebrity itself had a value that couldn't be replaced. And that's something I try to do a little bit of explanation of in the book, is why that is.
I'm sure that when you write something like this, when you write an historical novel, you spend a lot of time doing research, and you absorb all of this detail about the period that you're writing about. And that a lot of that goes into the book. And I know that some of the people who have reviewed the book have said they thought that there's too much. Now, I want to say I really enjoyed the book. I'm happy with the book the way it is. But I guess the question that I'm going for is, as a writer, When you do accumulate all this stuff and you want to use it, how do you decide at what point too much, you know, enough detail or the appropriate detail becomes too much?
Right. I think you get sort of an interior critic that lets you know when you're just starting to show off. You know, there's a point where you realize, no, you're just flapping your gums to hear yourself speak. And, you know, it's time to let that go, because, you know, the whole point is, you know, for me, the barometer for me is the audience's enjoyment of the book. For Carter, it was a simple, very simple idea, because there was one plot. You know, who killed the president? What did, you know, what's the secret that the president had when he was dying? And, you know, anything that didn't serve that, you could toss it out the window. In this case, it was a larger kind of worldview, and so it was a little bit more complex about what level of detail to go in there. But my first draft was originally 300 pages longer, and I cut it down because, for exactly that reason. I mean, I didn't want to slow things down. I wanted it to be a page turner. And then I gave it to my first set of readers, writers that I work with, and, you know, they gave me their feedback on it, what could use more explanation, what could use less. And then when I got it to my editors over at Knopf, they were nicely ruthless about it. You know, they had no interest. You know, the last thing I wanted was a review that said, you know, this guy's really smart. The book is 200 pages too long. I haven't gotten that. What some people have said is that they don't I wanted to write a book that would take a month to read and that people would, at the end of it, turn back and say, okay, how does this all fit together? I think that it's not, since it's not plot-driven, since it's driven by that kind of idea of ambition and America's expansion, I wanted to write stuff that, if you went back and read it again, you'd see, oh, okay, there's a Wild West show in the beginning because at the end, Hugo meets some Russian princesses, and there's kind of a reflection. The two scenes reflect each other. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think, I was thinking, though, that, you know, for me, I suppose a big test of this or any story is, do you care about what happens to these characters? And right. And I'm sure that I have started out reading novels that at some point I just said to myself, you know, I don't care anymore what happens to these people. Well, in my case with this book, that was not the case. I wanted to know what happened. And as you go along through the story, and I suppose it helps that what you can do is you can switch between one story and another. So you can leave one character at a point where there's a crisis, and then you can go back to another character, which, and I think as a device, that's it's the classic cliffhanger, I suppose, that maybe increases your desire to know, well, what happens with that person. But I'd say overall, the thing that I think that pulls you through the story is wanting to know what happens to that person.
That's actually the best possible reaction, and thank you, David. Because it's funny, people ask a lot about research, but what the key to the book, this is just between you and me, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay, good. The fact is, it's all about emotional resonance. You know, you can put all the detail in the world in a book or none, and it will have no impact if you don't have an emotional connection to the people to whom it's happening. And so that's the key. You use all the facts and details as window dressing for, if you care about Chaplin, do you care about, what's going to happen to him? That guides really, what his sets look like, or whether there were actually angels hanging from telephone poles in a scene in his movie, and things like that.
I'm sure that there are certain challenges when you use a character that was a real person with characters that you create. You literally create them, and you can do anything that you want with someone who was a real person. I'm sure that you feel constrained, at least in some respect, by the details of that person's actual life. What sort of challenge comes with bringing into your story a character, someone like Charlie Chaplin, who was a real person?
Yeah, I realized pretty early on that if I was going to do Charlie Chaplin, I would never know who the real Charlie Chaplin was. You know, I think if the real Charlie Chaplin read this book, he'd scoff. I mean, he'd enjoy all the sex scenes and everything, but he'd scoff at probably, oh, you think you got me out on this, on this table here. But I wanted to give the idea of it so that you felt like you were getting, if you knew something about Chaplin, he felt real. He felt like he breathed and lived, and you could understand him. And that was kind of my, that was the goalpost for me. And as far as sticking to the truth, though, I really felt most beholden to the diaries of the soldiers who were in Russia, because at first I thought, okay, this is an easy thing to make fun of, or it's an easy thing to be maudlin about, but then as I started reading their diaries and what their actual experiences were, I really thought, no one knows this stuff, and it's kind of important to stick to what their experience was. And their experience was quite surreal, quite like something out of a fairy tale. And I wanted to really color within the lines there, just to kind of pay tribute to them in that experience.
Yeah. Certainly today, I think because of mass media, there are people that we know way too much about, more than we really need to or want to know. And certainly we have now a category of people who are famous merely for being famous.
Right.
And it's hard sometimes to, it maybe is hard sometimes to feel sympathy for those people. And yet, sometimes I guess I'm moved to think what their life is like and the price that they've paid for being a celebrity. That, the fact that you just can't walk down the street without people following you and wanting to say hello and wanting to take your picture. And, you cannot have a normal life. I guess one of the things that it does make you reflect on in Chaplin's case is what his experience was like, what his life was like as a result of being as famous as he was, and what sort of pressures that he would have felt.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because I think it is hard for a lot of people to have sympathy for, you know, the famous, you know, because, you know, you think, well, they wanted to be famous and this is the price you pay for it. Well, Chaplin didn't, there was no template for him. This just all happened to him without him asking for it. He just wanted to make his movies and he enjoyed the money and he, you know, enjoyed the girls and enjoyed the power. But the other side of it was completely unexpected. And I, there's a scene in the book I have that's, I wanted just to show what it was like for him to try to walk across a party. And, you know, to, literally to get from the front door to the back door of the party, what hell it was, if you were him, and trying to be social. I grew up in Hollywood, and so, you know, I've seen, you know, not relatively up close what happens if you are famous and or a genius. You know, I've watched it happen to acquaintances. And I've seen how, like, gravity kind of warps around that person. Conversations change, people change behavior, and you know, I have sympathy for, you know, even, you know, whatever, you know, if there's certain odious people out there who've made horrific decisions, I have some sympathy for that, because it's a strange little bell jar to grow up under.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Glenn David Gold. We're talking about his new novel. It's titled Sunnyside, and it is published by Knopf. And questions would be welcome, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. You were talking a little bit earlier about the relationship between Pickford and Mary Pickford and Charles Chaplin, Charlie Chaplin, or at least in the sense how different they were. And that you said that Mary Pickford was like a machine, and that probably was what Chaplin thought, that she, the way that she churned out movies, the kind of personality and persona that she had on the screen and how she engineered stories. Another of the things I think in the book that's really interesting is some insight into Chaplin and how he worked and how it was that he truly made it up as he was going along. He might have had some idea to start with, but he truly relied on the inspiration of the moment, and I'm sure that there were many tortured moments when he was waiting for the word from the muse, and the word didn't come.
Right. Yeah, there's a terrific DVD called The Unknown Chaplin that was instrumental in understanding this. You know, most it's a mistake to think of silent film as anything as any less sophisticated in its working methods than current film. We have, you know, more jobs now and better film and all that stuff. But at the time, you know, there was a real factory in progress of doing everything very efficiently. You know, people wrote out the stories and they shot them and they knew how to do everything in the right order and then patch it all together and get it, you know, get it out the door so that every 2 weeks there was a new, you know, Harold Lloyd film. Chaplin was the only one who didn't work that way. He was the only one who had ideas, or, you know, he had gag men, but their jobs were a little shadowy. No one's really exactly sure how much input they had. But he would do things very slowly, carefully, get every single scene right before he went to the next scene. And then he might get like halfway through a movie and decide, oh, wait a minute. No. You know, first scene was wrong. We're doing it all differently now. And then throw everything out again and start over again. And I thought, you know, that's novelistic in a way. And he seems to be the only person maybe in the history of Hollywood who got to work that way. And I thought it was, there would be moments where that had to be overwhelming. I'm going to paraphrase Orson Welles really badly here, and I apologize for that, but I think he said something along the lines of that absolute artistic freedom is the absolute enemy of the artist.
Oh, I could see that, in his, particularly in his case.
Yeah,
I could see that.
And Chaplin, at one point, had complete artistic freedom, and I was interested in exploring, okay, when you have complete freedom, you might completely screw up.
And that must have driven the people around him who worked in his studio, that must have driven them crazy.
It must have, yeah. I think that being, you know, somebody... you know, it's funny. There was an article on Premier Magazine years ago that I always remember one little detail from it. It was about making The Deep, The Abyss, that movie that James Cameron made after Aliens. And apparently the crew wore T-shirts that said, "You can't scare me. I work for James Cameron." And I thought, okay, at a certain point, if you are on that, you know, on the set of somebody who's very demanding and knows what they want and also will, you know, kind of put you through the mill a bit, there really wouldn't be anything that scared you anymore.
Yeah. I suppose that the flip side of that, though, is that if you're the person and that everybody is, whether they're doing it literally or not, is looking at you and saying, okay, Mr. Creative Genius, let's go.
Yeah.
Let's produce. That kind of pressure, in addition to the kind of pressure that comes with having set a bar really high and feeling like you've got to make it or get over it every time, that must have been, I don't know how you stand up under that kind of pressure.
Right, yeah, and I know what you're saying, and I think that he, you know, I think I capture a moment in the book that he doesn't. I mean, he does collapse under this. But also, he's trying to drive himself to not just make comedies anymore. I mean, at a certain point, after he'd made 60 movies or something like that, he was starting to think, you know, it's the same formula in a while. You know, you get the girl, I don't get the girl, there's cops, there's no cops, there's a chase, whatever. Isn't there something more in life that I haven't captured yet? And he was kind of frantically trying to get nuances that he didn't quite know how to get. And I think that was also something that artistically was a puzzler for him.
Yeah, I think there's at one point where there's a character in the book who's a woman who is a writer who he is interested in, who says to him something along the lines of, you're not the movies that you're making are not as good as you are or could be or should be.
Yeah. She says, you haven't made movies yet that are as good as you are.
Yeah.
And I think that if, I wasn't a Chaplin fan when I started writing this book. I think that might have helped a bit for me because I didn't hold him in any particular reverence. But as I was watching the movies, I started to see something developing, which really was this great vocabulary of filmmaking. And then also the introduction of sentimentality and nuanced emotion, that it wasn't just humor, but there's also pathos to it that male comedians hadn't really thought of before. And I think he might have unconsciously borrowed from Pickford at a certain point and realized that he could maybe incorporate more than one emotion at once.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers here. I want to make sure I try to get him in. We'll go to Chicago for the first, line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Could you comment on the reason that led Charlie Chaplin to decide to leave the country and become the person that was outside of the mainstream film industry?
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Right. For people who are wondering, it was much later in his career. The book that I wrote, it ends in 1919, and Chaplin in the early 50s became a target of kind of the anti-communist forces. And one of the reasons for that was that Chaplin considered himself a citizen of the world. He considered himself above politics, but at the same time, he was also very critical of the United States and the atomic bomb, and felt that it was a horror that the world had come to that. And he had spoken out positively about Russia at a point when a lot of liberals in Hollywood had. And there was kind of a suspicion of him because he was living in America, but he wasn't really an American, and he was critical of America without really being an American, and there was kind of a building resentment toward him as part of a larger cultural shift, you know, back when the House of Un-American Activities. And I might get some slight details of this wrong, but this is what happens when you're a historical fiction guy. You know, things start to fill in, which aren't entirely accurate. But he was planning on taking a trip over to Europe, and he found out very quickly through sources in the government that if he left America, he might not be allowed back. So he had his wife, Una, who's Eugene O'Neill's daughter, more or less empty out the house while they were preparing to go, and they just moved everything overseas, and he ended up settling in Switzerland. And he continued to be denounced for years by kind of protectors of the flag. And then he was re-welcomed back in 1972, and all was forgiven, and it was a very emotional moment for him. He got an honorary Oscar, and he realized that there were no hard feelings held against him.
All right, and another caller here, Joliet, line number one. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
I just rented Chaplin with Robert Downey.
Ooh.
With Robert Downey.
Yes.
The wonderful movie. I just thought it was an incredible impersonation. So then I got interested, and then, of course, through Netflix, I was able to rent all the movies that I had read about for years and had never been able to see. And the two that struck me were The Great Dictator and Limelight. And when I realized that The Great Dictator was made in 1940, it was incredible that a man was thinking about that, was expressing stuff, and made a movie about that kind of treatment of the Jews. I was floored. I just thought this was a spectacular effort on this guy standing all alone in the world, really.
Yeah. I'm very glad that you noticed that. It's for those who aren't familiar with the movie, it is very well worth renting. It's a talkie, so you don't have to worry about not hearing anything. In 1940, Chaplin made a movie in which he basically played himself and Hitler. And it was a movie that really drove Hitler crazy because it made fun of him. But it also presciently pointed out the plight of the Jews in a way that nobody else was really addressing. I mean, I think it was Shaw said that, you know, if you're going to tell the truth, you better be funny, otherwise they'll kill you. and Chaplin really embraced that. He got that. And that wasn't the first time he did that. 1918, he made a movie called Shoulder Arms, which was the first American movie really set in the trenches, and it was a comedy. And everybody thought, they'll kill you. How can you make fun of the soldiers? You have to be patriotic. Well, he managed to have great sympathy for the soldiers and showed their plight in a way that made the soldiers themselves laugh. And it was very simple, but that's kind of the essence of genius.
Yeah. In Limelight, I wonder, I know that you stopped at 1919 or so, but in Limelight, there's an awful lot of just him doing vaudeville bits. Was that just an occasion for him to redo what he did as a young man in the theater?
Yeah, I think that's an eternal argument among film scholars about what was going on exactly at that point. I mean, in a way, it was him taking his bow and getting... there's some bits that he does there were things that he recycled or always wanted to put in a movie but never got to it. And I think... But what I actually... From having watched the movie a couple times and read his autobiography, I think in Limelight, he kind of looked at his alternate life. What if he had just... If he hadn't had the success, if he'd had the talent and the drive and the want to do it, but had never really tasted it, what would his life have been like? And so I think he used these bits that he knew were good, but not quite as good as he could have been. And that's what makes it a very painful and lovely movie to watch.
The last thing was, it was remarkable that everybody learned that Michael Jackson's favorite song was Smile, written...
Yeah.
By Charlie Chaplin, and I think it was from the movie Limelight, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Chaplin wrote the music, and the lyrics are really eerie. And I end my book with that, actually. Not with Michael Jackson, but with the song Smile, because his fascination with people's smiles. I would just say that his first wife, actually, and this is something that's in the book, she joined an early Hollywood cult, religion/cult, which believed you could solve all your problems if you just smiled or laughed at them. And that seems rather innocent enough, but there's a moment, it's the last image of the book, where it's kind of taken to a horrifying extreme. And that actually, based on Chaplin's letters, I don't think I would say more about it. But Chaplin's relationship with smiling was a little more complicated than he let on.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, we're down to about 2 minutes left. And I know I asked this question. You'll forgive me for asking this question because I know that you worked on this book for a long time, worked 8 years on this novel. But I'm sure that people would say, gee, that was a nice book. So what do you got going now? as if they're expecting the next one, you know, next week. But you can see how first you got interested in stage magic, and you were interested in Houdini, and that led to Carter, and that you thought maybe you got interested in Chaplin because of your interest in Houdini and the fact that you had seen this picture of the two men, of Chaplin and Houdini together. Do you have some thoughts about what kind of story you'd like to tell next?
Yeah, I'm actually right now working on some shorter pieces. I'm writing the libretto for an opera that's based on a stage magician. The composer is named Gavin Bryars. He's a British musician who's quite brilliant. I'm also working on some short stories, and I'm working on short things now. I'd like them to come out faster than the next 8 years. if that's a fair answer.
Well, it certainly is. Well, and I know that it's sometimes I think even in your own conversations I've had with writers, you're tempted to ask that question, so what are you working on now? And I think there are sometimes I have talked to people who have said, I just don't want to talk about it.
They say,
I just prefer not to say, and I'm not – and that's certainly a fine response, and I could understand that response. But as I say, it's sort of – it's easy for me after you've written this huge book for it to come along and say, so what else you got for me?
Right.
I'm sure that's tough for writers, because I'm sure all people like me are always asking, okay, what's the next thing?
Yeah. The plan is to, re-release my first two books as my collected works of that.
Well, and I also, I know that you have been a sometime screenwriter. One of the things that I read about the book is it seems like the irony is that here you've written a book about Hollywood that's unfilmable.
Oh, yeah, you read that, didn't you?
and although you sort of wonder, because I think there was actually some interest in one time trying to turn Carter into a movie.
Oh, yeah.
I think Sunnyside probably truly is too much.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Carter was optioned by Tom Cruise repeatedly. And just recently, AMC, the people who did Mad Men, were interested in doing it as a TV series, which I think would have been a pretty good idea. But
no,
that's fine. But that's all right. I kind of like the idea of writing something that stumps people. Somebody somewhere will probably come along and figure out a way and surprise me.
All right. The book is Sunnyside by our guest Glenn David Gold. It is recently out, published by Knopf. You also might want to read his first novel, Carter Beats the Devil. Mr. Gold, thanks very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.